It's the What the Hell Happened This Week edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, live election coverage, listener feedback, the end of terrorism, end of aliens, and I Spy by Apple. This is episode 113.
But when you talk about destruction, don't you know that you can count me out?
Don't you know it's gonna be
alright? Alright. Alright. You say you got a real solution. Well, you know, we don't love to see the plan. You ask me for a contribution. Well, you know, we all do what we can. But if you want money for people with minds that hate, all I can tell you is, brother, you have to wait.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, and of course also heard by our friends in Kamloops on CFBX. My name is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher.
And this is Daniel, vice president of the UBC Freethinkers. I almost said president there. Now I am vice president.
You know, guys, you know, this has been such an exciting week. Has it been? I mean, there's been this like really big, huge thing internationally about marriage. I don't know if you've heard about
down.
This. Well, you know, it's huge. I mean, everyone's been all the Twitter about it. Apparently, finally, Charlie Sheen got his divorce. I mean, isn't that huge?
Yeah.
I'm sure it's the biggest thing that's happened in the world as far as marriage news goes.
Did anything else happen?
Well, you know, apparently one of the most vile people in American culture got hit. Apparently Justin Bieber got egged in Australia. And of course, just to round out the news.
Isn't Bieber Canadian?
Yes, he was.
So he's one of the most reviled Canadians.
He's
reviled by
now.
Americans because they think that he supported the Ground Zero Mosque, so they kind of hate him for all that. And
yeah.
Not that we like him much. Well, he's
there's plenty of reasons to hate him, I think, though, actually.
But let's
moving
go,
on.
Let's
what
go
else
back
happened,
to Canada, right? I mean, obviously, right. Canada this week, as everyone knows, huge news has been in all the papers. It's been a very bittersweet news as far as victories and losses go, right? Because, I mean, obviously, everyone is just shocked and stunned that the Habs lost their series, but everyone's really happy the Canucks won theirs. Other than that, I don't think too much has happened last week, has it?
Well, what about the royal wedding, Don?
The what?
The royal wedding. Future king of England.
Did they get married?
And Canada, and a couple other countries too.
Wow.
Married some woman, yeah.
Well, yeah, I guess
not,
I guess
my
that's,
king.
That's a bit bigger than my Charlie Sheen. But I mean, I got the rest of them right. I mean, you know, this. I mean, egging Bieber. Bieber is a huge, huge guy.
What were you up to yesterday?
I was...
Spent 17 hours doing nothing important?
No, nothing. Why? Did something happen? I mean, I was really tired after working at the poll stations, but I assumed that vote thing, you know, I mean, who cares about elections? A lot of people were sitting there saying, do I really have to vote again? I mean, how much could have changed in the country overnight?
Well, a lot.
We're going to find out, unfortunately. But it's actually funny you mentioned that. Something about 39% of Canadians were like, meh, election... Nah.
Yeah, so I have the results in front of me. Drum roll, please. I'm sure you haven't heard this before. Thank you, Don. Winning the election with 167 votes, which is more than enough to form a majority government.
What would be the majority government?
155.
Okay.
Just testing me on my
your math acuity.
So 167 seats with only 39.5% of the vote. Wow. So basically, they got 55 to 60% of the seats with about 40% of the vote.
What would their proportional seats have been?
122.
For all those people who voted against proportional representation, remember that when the choice comes up again.
Next up, quite interestingly, is not the Liberals for basically the first time in history.
No. The Bloc has been the official opposition before.
When the Liberals won.
When the Liberals won. The Liberals have always been one or two, is what I meant.
Oh, okay.
This is the first time they haven't been either appointed to government or leading the official opposition.
The Greens?
No. The NDP. The orange wave has crushed through into Quebec and slaughtered millions. So they won 102 seats, which is more than the Liberals had last election, with 30.5% of the vote. So they got a lot less seats than the Conservatives, with only 10% less of the vote. Proportionally, they would have had 95. Then next up is one of the two really big losers of the night. The Liberals with 34 seats, 19% of the vote. Looking at it, though, another way, if you look at it by percent of vote, they should have had a lot, or quite a bit more than 34. They should have been up at 59. So they weren't, in terms of popular vote, it was less extreme of a difference between the NDP and Liberals than the seat count goes, which just shows you even more how broken the system is. And then, almost embarrassingly, the Bloc Québécois only got 4 seats, down from 48 before the election. Their leader, Gilles Duceppe, lost his seat and resigned. Same with the leader of the Liberals, Michael Nadiev. He lost his seat, too. So that's sort of embarrassing for both of them.
Who did they lose their seats to?
Nadiev lost it to a conservative with the last name Trottier. I can't remember. I don't know if this is related to CFIs.
Probably not. I'm just wild guess, probably not.
And so, basically, I don't think he was a big-name conservative or anything. That makes it almost a little harder.
Yeah.
And Gilles Duceppe, I don't think he lost a huge name or anything either.
But he did lose by, 5,000 votes, so he lost, he lost big.
Yeah.
It wasn't like he lost by 2 votes or anything.
The Bloc Québécois got hammered. And then, this is probably one of, the biggest wins for many people out there. As you know, for skeptics, sometimes iffy on this party, but the Green Party got 1 seat, which is amazing.
You know, it's funny, too, because looking at that, in the one sense, the Greens are ecstatic because they finally now have a toehold in Parliament. Finally, someone can say they're
a legitimate
party.
Toe, not like a large toe.
But I think if I remember the last elections, their percentage of the popular vote has gone down, actually. And I think they got less this time than they did last time.
I think it went down 1%. They're at 4% now. If we had proportional representation, that 4% would be 13 seats. So this 1 seat, it's great for our current system, but proportionally, they should do a lot better.
And I point out for those people who listen to the leftist news that Democracy Now! Predicted on Monday that if we had, they didn't say this, but if we had proportional representation, we would have had a minority government with the NDP heading it. And of course, Monday, everyone else would have said, that's silly, stupid Americans don't know our politics. How close they were to it.
Well, I mean, this is a huge, huge win for the NDP. I mean, it's very similar to, I think, the progression of the Labour Party in the UK. They eventually supplanted the Liberals as sort of the party on the left. We will see if that happens this year, or well, this next 4 years, see an election for another 4 years.
Barring a huge change in the Liberals, I think the NDP is going to stay as sort of, the NDP and Liberals are going to stay as the 1-2 party for a while.
Well, actually, it's funny, too. I mean, one, for those people who have said, Daniel kind of has maybe sort of said, maybe not, that this is the death of the Liberals and how we had the progressive conservatives who had a historic defeat and they never did quite recover from that. To be fair, when the progressive conconservatives got wiped out, they were wiped out to 2 seats, which is not quite as bad as what's happened to the Liberals.
I wouldn't say it's a historic defeat for the Liberals because they've never done gone this bad. But I don't think the Liberal Party is about to disappear or anything. They just have too storied of a history in Canada. Too much like, there's still like, probably on campuses, biggest groups for politics are usually the Liberal groups.
But I think, though, there's one thing, and again, because I'm sort of steeped in this sort of part of the spectrum of politics, even before the last federal election, the quote-unquote party elders, John Chrétien, Ed Broadbent, were discussing ideas of merging the left, so to speak, right, the left parts of the Liberal Party with the NDP, to form a coalition to help do sort of what the Reform and conservative, progressive conservatives did on the right. And I think, if anything, after this election, the number two person in the Liberal Party, from what I understand, is probably still going to be Bob Rae. In fact, he's probably going to have an even stronger role now in the party,
yeah,
because the shift to the right that Ignati have kind of shown has shown to be a false way to go.
Yeah, and he did actually retain his seat, which is a rarity for Liberals. So he is definitely up there, front runner. Hmm. Maybe with like Justin Trudeau, but he's still young.
Very young indeed. Well, we got a great show today. We're going to be looking at some email questions from listeners, as well as some news from SETI, as well as perhaps a bit more information on other election issues. Taxes are always fun topics here on Radio Free Thinker. And then we're going to look into the mystery of the stalking iPhone and other hacking and stealing of personal data.
If only Osama had one of those on him for a while.
Actually, you know, it's funny because when I was doing my search for things...
I have no idea where this is going to go.
No. I seen two really, really interesting cartoons recently. One, of course, just because I thought it was funny, and I'm going to bring it back for the election.
Hopefully Don remembers radio is a... auditory
was for the Metro, and you had this cartoon of Harper sitting there in a closet in his drawers and all that, looking desperately for something. He's trying to find something. He's all excited and he's all worried, and he's shouting to his wife, dear, where did I hide that secret agenda? Which I just laugh. But no, the one pertinent with the tracking stuff and all that is, I don't know if you guys had heard, but there was a huge breakout in Afghanistan of prisoners who had dug a tunnel and they had escaped right underneath American eyes. So this thing was, the new procedure that the Americans apparently are doing is that they're issuing iPhones to every prisoner in Afghanistan so that if they escape, they can track them down again.
That's not a real thing, is it?
It was a cartoon. I did mention cartoon.
Yeah, I know. But
so the cartoon is a real thing.
Maybe like the old.
But I don't
iPhones.
Think that's a policy. Yes.
There was probably funny drawings next to it too.
Yeah.
No, not that really. But I mean, people are sitting there saying, "What the heck are you talking about?" Well, you're going to have to listen towards the end of the show to find out we're talking about that. What else have we got coming up right now? What can we talk about now? I want to talk.
Well,
about something.
Right now we're going to dive into a listener email, and this one relates back to when we were talking about the burqas and the niqabs. And a listener writes: first off, I'm not a Catholic, conservative, or a bigot, which is always a good thing to start your emails with.
Yes. We don't want to mistake you for one.
Yeah. Just listen to Radio Free Thinker podcast episode 1110, and I have to take exception. Analogy to the burqa and the ski mask is ridiculous. I'm hazarding a guess here, but I would think that if I walked into a business with a ski mask on, even in winter, and I didn't remove it, I do believe I would receive as much, if not vastly more attention than a religious face covering. Most people wear ski masks for inclement weather, not religion. Why does one religious belief make any difference in how they are treated or expected to act in public? Given the show's anti-Western religious emphasis, e.g. this episode and Catholic school board's monopoly, I am left feeling skeptical about your skepticism.
Lou. I doubt that.
Well, to be fair,
I'm skeptical about your skepticism of my...
It's good that listeners are skeptical of us, because we are by far, ivory tower gods or anything.
No, we have said lots of times that, you know, you should always assess something based on the argument, not on who said it. And just because we have a talk show, doesn't give us some sort of privileged knowledge. And you should go out and double check what we said. And we always appreciate listener feedback or listener corrections, because we'll get some things wrong.
Absolutely.
And just as a point of clarification, your intro did remarkably sound like, I'm not really a racist, but is not really the good way to start a thing. Because usually what follows right after that, tends to make you say, I don't think it happened in this case. In fact, I think it came across quite well.
Yeah, and I think the main issue here, the sort of ski mask comparison that we made in episode 110, it's not a perfect analogy, but I think it works sometimes, you know. If you walk into a business like a bank wearing a ski mask, you might get some odd looks or be asked to remove it. But this is partly because certain locations have a security element. Banks, of course, have a security element. Now, you know, and I think it's quite reasonable that banks should have a security element. They have lots of money there. But I think it's worth noting that this ban on the burqa and the niqab includes being outdoors, not just in banks. Yeah. So, I mean, even if you're out building a snowman in the winter wearing a ski mask or a burqa...
Or skiing with the burqa.
Sure, you could be asked to remove it, not just in the bank. And I think that's an important difference here.
Yeah, no, and to play devil's advocate, there's another important difference, too, is if you're wearing the ski mask, be it outside or in a bank, for a limited time, I can say, hey, Ethan, could you please take off your face mask? I just want to make sure that you are who you say you are. You can do that with a ski mask, but you can't do that with a burqa, or at least it's forbidden by religious custom. So I think, in a way, we have both sides here where they don't quite pair up well, mm-hmm. but they both reemphasize the same point.
Yes,
absolutely. Well, so that's a good way of looking at it. I think if we're going to be good skeptics, we have to ask, you know, what additional benefits a law like this brings to the table. And we have to understand that we're dealing with, like we said, a culture that is, you know, to a certain degree, repressing its people. And if we further repress them by making laws that makes them going to stay indoors, we're not really helping the situation very much.
No, actually, maybe a better analogy. And again, see, anyone who's ever argued with me gets so frustrated because I will make a point and then I will spend the next 20 minutes arguing against that very point I have spent 20 minutes arguing for.
So, it's true.
So here's another scenario for you. Let's take the ski mask off the table, because one of the other issues that's come up with this whole burqa thing, above and beyond the effects on the individual, which of course, you know, very few people would support the subjugation of women by oppressive things, while at the same time wanting to support individual freedom of expression. But the effect on other people by making them feel uncomfortable, that it somehow seems inappropriate for our cultural standards. And we say, well, yes, but I mean, why are your cultural standards any better than others? But we already have another one. Let's flip it right on the reverse. Let's say not Muslims, let's say Martians, a new religious cult that comes out there, and one of the precepts of them is that women are not allowed to wear any clothes in public. So you have a bunch of these women who are running around stark naked. And it's against the religion to have any form of covering. Now,
that's like the Ferengi in Star Trek.
Yes, well, it's true. Nerd reference number 382.
Yes.
So that being said, I mean, we do have laws right now that prohibit nudity in public. And the only reason why we have these laws for nudity in public is because some people find it offensive. They find it somehow off-putting or fearful. And we seem to accept that. But with the burqa, we seem to say, well, yes, you know, they should have sort of the freedom in one sense to wear the burqa, but at the same time, it makes a number of members of our culture feel uncomfortable, so maybe we should limit it in that way, too.
So have burqa beaches?
Well, you know, I think, again, most people who are on this argument one way or the other don't tend not to argue that people should not be able to, at least in the privacy of their own group, mm-hmm. be able to wear and behave however they wish. It's only when this interaction becomes a public issue that it becomes controversial. And again, I mean, there's both sides of it. I mean, I still don't like the burqa, and I hate it being treated as special just because it's religious.
Sure.
But if you take that religious aspect out of it, then it leads up to another whole bunch of other questions.
Hmm. Like I said, there's probably no easy answer to this question, and most likely we'll be debating it for episodes to come. But let's go into another email here. This one comes from David, and he writes, I work downtown Vancouver, one block from Robson Square, which is the site of a lot of protests and rallies, most recently the 420 marijuana event. I noticed that when the protesters get covered on the news, there always seems to be an argument between the event organizers and the police about how many people attended. The discrepancy is usually large, sometimes by an order of magnitude. He gives an example from an article in the Vancouver Sun. And the article said that the police estimated 5,000 people, while the organizers claimed the number was more like 10,000. And he asked, is there any evidence about who is usually correct in these kind of disputes and whose numbers are more trustworthy?
Well, first of all, David, an order of magnitude is usually considered to be 10 times.
For God's sake.
I know, I'm pedantic. Okay, sorry.
Yeah, so it seems like at best, this is a very imperfect estimation. Unless you get aerial photographs of like an open area and then really analyze it, it's very difficult to get accurate counts.
Right. Typically, the only real way to do it is if you have a ticketed event.
Yeah, or a ticketed event. It's even better.
Actually, from what I understand, in the United States, and we talked about this before the show, in the United States, the American Park Board actually has a very complex and effective system for doing this, and they have the aerial photos, and they have people with little magnifying glasses counting heads, and they're statistically very accurate. But the one of the things that plays into this is there's a lot of politics involved here, because the Parks Board needs this information because it needs to maintain the grounds, and they need to make sure that they have correct infrastructure for it. So it's important data for them to have this. But there was a few rallies during the Bush administration that there was a lot of debate about the numbers, and it became government policy for the Parks Board to not publish these numbers because they were accurate, and they didn't want accurate numbers out there. They wanted the one side or the other to promote their own political agenda. Mm-hmm. And as you were pointing out, the police obviously have an incentive to promote one number. The organizers have an incentive to produce another number, each having different political aims.
So basically, be very skeptical of both numbers.
Well, the other thing, too, there are some methods out there, but they're all kind of iffy. One that I was sort of reading on was a method called Jacob's Method, which is named for its inventor, Herbert Jacob. And basically what he would do is you look at large areas of land and then sort of estimate what the density of the people there. And then you sort of make an estimate, and then you kind of count up your areas and get a number that way. And that produces usually lower numbers than what, event organizers would like. As we were saying, if you have two groups who are politically motivated in any way, shape, or form, they're going to give you skewed numbers.
Yeah.
It's very difficult to come up with anything other than, literally photographing the whole thing and counting them all one by one. And that's just kind of boring.
Well, and then you have the whole other issue is, what about if you have an event that lasts 4 hours or something, right?
Yeah.
And at the beginning of the event, you have, and we'll pretend that we are the spaghetti monster and we know everything, and we count that there are 10,000 people at the beginning of the event. Then a band comes up or something, and it swells to 100,000. And then some people get bored and they leave, and it becomes 50,000. And then towards the end, people have trailed off, and there's only 5,000. So do you use the peak number? Do you use the not peak number? How do you slice that particular potato?
Yeah, exactly. And the fact that, the way you sort of remember an event can also be influenced later on, right? If you really want there to be 10,000 people there, you might think, oh, I definitely see 10,000 people, when it looks more like, 3,000 or something.
Or even in some of the events. First of all, let's pretend you have an event, 100,000 people show up. And it's like Charlie Sheen's very first performance, whatever, right? They showed up, everyone was excited, he gets on stage, everyone says, oh my God, this guy's a turkey, and they all leave. So you could honestly say 100,000 people showed up, hated what we said, and left. And I don't know if that's really a good thing to have happen.
Yeah.
Or two, again, in a lot of these things you'll get, 100,000 people showed up, 50,000 of them for, 50,000 of them against. So, because people, you get these protests and counter-protests going on, and how do you add those numbers up?
Exactly.
I just think it's one of those unknowable questions, like so much of science. And you need a different way of knowing the universe than just pure numbers.
You're off the show.
Okay.
Let's go to a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be back with more after this.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in 5 words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Become a friend of CITR and receive great discounts at businesses around Vancouver.
Your Friends of CITR card will get you discounts on Main Street at Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear,
Woo Vintage,
The Kiss Store, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, Red Cat Records, The Regional Assembly of Text, RX Comics, Temple of the Modern Girl,
Flaming Angels Boutique,
and the Wallflower Modern Diner.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus, or visit us online at citr.ca.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So, Don, you have some sad news about the search for extraterrestrial life.
Yes, apparently aliens are dead. Well, okay, they're not dead, but they're dead to me, or dead to us. The SETI Institute apparently has been forced to temporarily shut down its Allen Telescope Array. And it's, I think it's about 40 or 50... radio antennas that they have just outside of San Francisco. It was named after Paul Allen of Microsoft fame, who helped spearhead a lot of money to get this set up. Now, there's just not enough money to go around to maintain the operation of this as a scientific facility.
One that really confuses me about this, it costs $1.5 million a year to maintain it. For someone like Paul Allen, that's not that much money.
Well, no, but apparently the big thing they have, and this is a, Paul Allen apparently came up with a significant amount of the funds originally to set up the array. He has been helping out, and he's kind of sitting there saying, hey guys, there's more to this than just me. I want to be part of a group of people who are supporting this, but, you know, I'm not your sugar daddy. And in that sort of sense, I kind of agree with him. I mean, I think, yes, he could pay for this, and maybe ultimately he will. But at the same time, I mean, if we put all of our trust in rich people and their benevolence, well, that's not good. I don't trust rich people, even if they are trying to be good, unless it's me.
Really?
But no, to be fair though, there's actually this is part one of a two-step scenario that's going on. So the first thing they're doing is they're shutting it down, so it's no longer going to be used for scientific research. But it's still going to cost them a certain amount of money each year, and I forget what the number is, just to maintain the operation so they don't degrade, right? Because, I mean, just because you're not using them doesn't mean they don't get weather. Someone's got to go out there and oil the wheels and make sure it doesn't rust up. And apparently they can kind of afford to keep that going for a few years, but if funding isn't stepped up, if we don't get a massive popular popular support to help maintain the Allen Telescope, then it goes into its second level of shutdown, which is literally abandonment of the site. And that,
see, I don't get why like AT&T doesn't step in and sponsor them. It can be like, AT&T, you don't get any coverage here, and we don't get any coverage of aliens.
Actually, but no, it's you. It'd be good. Verizon, right? We don't only get your phone calls. Our phone system is intergalactic.
I'm sure there are some pretty good catchphrases for it.
But you see, this is someone like myself who often, you know, pushes the whole idea of socialism and all that, right? This is the exact problem with people, especially the libertarian inkling, who think all we need to do is rely upon either mass support or the philanthropy of those people who have, and all the things we want to have done will be done. And no, and there are some things that I think are important, and I think people are willing to support. I think if there was a referendum at this last election saying, hey, would you be willing to kick in 10 cents to help support SETI for a year? I think most everyone probably would have said yes, or at least enough people would have to let it done. And then you would have had this, you know, organized support for it instead of this haphazard thing. How much time and effort are the people at SETI running around desperately trying to get funders to help support this on an ongoing basis instead of doing the actual science and research that we hope that they were putting into it in the first place? On another note, seeing as they're just stunned by my argument here. For all those people who have SETI at home, which is a popular program that you, when your screensaver comes up, it analyzes sound data from things like the They analyze radio frequencies from space on your personal computer and
trying to determine if it's from aliens.
Right. Now, this isn't actually part of SETI directly. It's actually part of Berkeley, and this is going to be continuing on. The SETI group itself is actually involved in more other projects than just the Allen Telescope that they're also involved in. I'm trying to remember some of the other things that they were involved in, but a lot of it is exobiology.
What's that?
Nothing. they're also involved in things like exobiology. Is there life on Mars? Is there life on other planets, right? So SETI itself isn't disappearing or going away. It's just this one particular research project, our ears to space, that are being shut down at the moment. Unless, of course, again, some new things can be found. And apparently, the timing could not be worse, right? As I think we've mentioned on the show, or anyone who's listened to Science Podcast, the Kepler Telescope Project, right, which is designed to find exoplanets out in the universe, has discovered, over 1,000 new stars that have planets orbiting around them, which are potential radio sources for intelligent life. And now the Allen Array Telescope could be pointed towards these to be more effective. I mean, up until now, we've been kind of pointing at, an educated guess as to where this should come from. But now, thanks to this new information, we actually have some physical evidence that at least there are planets around these stars, so the chances of there being something there have exponentially increased. But now that we know where to look, we no longer have anything to look with.
Well, speaking of perhaps big cell phone companies in space, did you guys know that your iPhone is stalking you?
I don't have an iPhone. Oh. That's because I knew it was out to get
you. Oh, you knew it was out to get you?
Your iPod Touch is stalking? No, it isn't.
Well, if it's a new generation iPod Touch, perhaps. But recently, news spread around that the Apple iPhone and iPads were secretly tracking personal data about their users. And for what purpose, no one knows. Yes, researchers Pete Warden and writer Alistair Allen, a senior research fellow in astronomy at the University of Exeter, were the ones who uncovered the issue. They were working on some location data visualization projects, and during that process discovered suspicious files on their iPhones.
Can anyone else just picture Steve Jobs sitting in a giant room full of TVs with, like, up-to-date locations of where everyone with an iPhone is?
I can put that pretty much, yeah.
He's sitting there with going, yes, my people, they're everywhere.
What's happening is that the devices that are running iOS 4 are gathering location information and storing it in an unencrypted file, the file name consolidated.db, and it contains location data about cell phone cell towers and devices that access Wi-Fi networks that they're in range of. So it's got, sort of triangulated location information that it creates from the various cell phone towers and Wi-Fi networks that you use.
To be fair, the reason why they use the triangulated things, and one of my pet peeves with all these portable devices, the iPhone, the iPad, the Zoom, the Playbook, all of them, none of them have GPS. None of them have proper GPS in them. What they do is it's called assisted GPS, where it takes signals from cell phone towers or Wi-Fi senders, and from those locations, it guesstimates where you are from that by triangulation. Mm-hmm. So that's why
the iPhone actually does have a legitimate GPS in it as well.
I thought it didn't. I was looking at that, but maybe you're right.
No, okay. It has both.
The iPad doesn't.
Yeah, the iPad doesn't. But with the iPhone, it does have a legitimate GPS as well as using cell towers, because cell towers gives you a really quick, basic one.
That point being, and the fact that it's non-encrypted is actually kind of makes some sense. I mean, We talked about Steve Jobs sitting there going, whoa, all my people and all that. But I think, I mean, the non-conspiracy nature of this, right, is that one, I mean, Apple is a for-profit corporation, and it's sort of the modern version of Big Brother, right, who's out there to keep its finger in all pies to make some money. So it's not encrypted, so that third-party users like Starbucks or whatever can know where you are so as to pinpoint advertising towards you. And, I mean, if it was sort of, ooh, they're evil sort of thing, you think they would have encrypted it. But from what I understand, the real big issue isn't so much that they're having this tracking information, but one, that it is unencrypted, which means anybody can have access to it who has access to your phone. And two, there's
access to your computer, because it auto-downloads when you connect your computer, when your phone to iTunes. So
yeah, it does go onto your computer.
And the fact that you can't turn it off.
Well, according to Allen and Warden, the tracking didn't begin until iOS 4, which was released in late June 2010. And the previous version of iOS did, in fact, track a similar set of information, including cell towers and GPS information, but that data was not stored in a simple directory format, which is this sort of unencrypted file that's just sort of sitting there. The database of location information is stored primarily on your phone, but because it does back up on iTunes, these files end up on your computer. So if somebody ever got it in their head that they want to stalk you, if they stole your computer or hacked into it somehow, they could get that information.
Sorry, just to point out, if someone is breaking into my apartment to steal my computer, stalking would probably be lower down on my worries. I mean, they've already gone to the point of breaking into my apartment. Well, I mean, I admit stalking is not a good thing, but...
What's more likely is, like, a botnet, like, that gets a whole bunch of computers through, like, online, not through some individual stealing your computer.
Oh, so someone hacking into my computer to get the information.
Yes. More on that later.
Right. Well, the concern, as researchers point out, is that the information is unencrypted. And to quote them, by passively logging your location without your permission, Apple has made it possible for anyone from a jealous spouse to a private investigator to get a detailed picture of your movements. So, predictably, this has caused quite an uproar, including Senator Al Franken, who is the chair of the new privacy panel for the U.S. government, sent a letter to Steve Jobs requesting an explanation. In addition, the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, is reportedly looking into the matter, and a congressman from Washington State has also sent out sort of a letter demanding answers. Perhaps this is being a bit silly because many of these congressmen are trying to score points with the public.
Yeah.
So how come we haven't sent out a letter?
I don't know.
Let's get our secretary on that.
Yeah, we should do that.
Joan, send a letter out. Thank you.
The question is, should we skeptics be getting worked up about this? Now, it turns out that this actually isn't all that new information. Location tracking has been discussed last year by digital forensic specialists, and Apple did respond in a 2010 letter saying that its location tracking was purely to improve its services. And in addition, they're actually not breaking any rules. Mm-hmm. Apple clearly spells this out in its terms of use, that it has the right to collect, use, and share location data anytime it wants. And also, Apple isn't the only company to do this either. Some phones that run Google's Android OS also store location information as well.
In defense of Android, though, when you first set up your phone, it asks you if you want to let Google anonymously take this information. So it's at least giving you the option to opt out right away.
Yeah. It's also worth noting that there is no evidence that this data is actually being sent to Apple. The researchers also admitted that there is also, quote, no immediate harm that would seem to come from the availability of this data, which kind of flies in the face of that previous quote. In terms of privacy, cell phone companies have always had access to this data, and normally it would take a court order to retrieve this data by law enforcement, which occasionally will happen. Apple has stated they collect the data anonymously in a form that does not personally identify someone and is used by Apple and their partners and licensees to provide and improve location-based products and services, so things like, you know, Foursquare or your Google Maps thing.
Even helps like the cell phone companies decide where to put new cell towers.
Sure, yeah.
So, I don't know. It seems to me like this whole thing has been blown out of proportion quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. It's worth noting that the iPhone's position is not being continuously tracked, so it's not like it's sending off a homing signal every time you use it. It's only when you get that sort of like little arrow thing in the corner that comes on.
Which if you look on your cell phone next time, right, on the top right-hand corner, you'll see a bunch of little icons, and one of them will be, it's like a little arrow, a little thing
that kind of blinks on and off.
What the heck is that?
And yeah.
You go, well, that's them making a note to where you are.
So one question is, why is the file unencrypted? And so I did some reading, looked at some different, you know, theories online, and from what I can understand, it probably has something to do with how the iPhone collects location of available Wi-Fi networks. Apple's iOS devices have three ways to determine your location. They can collect GPS data, provided the device supports GPS and can get a signal from enough GPS satellites. It can utilize cell tower triangulation, provided we're talking about the original iPhone or a 3G iPad and a cell connection can be established, or refer to a database of known Wi-Fi networks. A few years ago, Apple began building its own database of Wi-Fi networks and their locations, this so they don't have to use a third party's database. So as they build their own global, you know, Wi-Fi phone book type thing, they collect data from their phones and their user base to figure, okay, where are all the hotspots type stuff? And Apple is not alone in doing this. BlackBerry and all the other ones probably do this as well. So it is kind of, I think, a bit overblown, this notion that, that you know, Apple is secretly tracking you, even though they kind of sometimes are.
Well, and again, I think there's three things that I think will go into this. The first one, in an odd sort of way, the fact that it's not encrypted is kind of a good thing, if you think about it. Because, I mean, one, that means I have access to the information that is collected, right? I mean, if I can get the right program, I can look at what it is storing about me and I don't need some special thing. Also, if I want to hide where I am, because it's an unencrypted thing, I'm sure there's a hacker out there somewhere who's developed a tool to mask your movements.
Yeah. Well, on that point, we will link to a thing on our website that can show you how to delete the file on iTunes so that your phone does not copy that data over. There is one other little thing nugget about this that is kind of interesting, is that why did the iPhone store months and months of data? Why does it keep building it? Why is it not, you know, refreshing every little while? And the consensus view is that it's actually a bug. Simply, from what I understand, from performance reasons and space reasons, it would make a lot of sense that this location information would be just sort of cleared out periodically, but it's not. It's just kind of piling up. So chances are someone didn't code it right, and it's just stockpiling, which could, you know, explain why sometimes your phone starts to act a little strange when you're doing all this location data.
Well, and I'm sure, and that goes into to the third part that I was going to mention, too, is there's a certain amount of corporate arrogance, or perhaps corporate blindness, to put it more neutral in the idea, is that someone in marketing or research says, hey, guys, you know, in programming, we'd really like some way that we can kind of keep track of where the people are going so that we can use this marketing information, track where hotspots are. Could you guys put a little, I don't know, something in there, just a little flag so that we could do that? And the programmers go, oh, yeah, that's no problem. And they go off on there, and no one at any time went to the privacy commissioner, whoever they have in there, saying, should you really be doing this? Is this really sort of an ethical thing to do? Mm-hmm. And I think probably that's another sidestep to it.
Well, you know, this sort of like segues into another sort of privacy-related issue that sort of came up around the same time, and that is that Sony got hacked. And over the past few weeks, gamers...
Ethan, I hate to tell you this. Yeah. Sony's been hacked. So I have so many friends of mine who have modded their PlayStation.
Yeah,
I
mean, that's not what I'm talking about. Over the past few weeks, gamers were mystified when Sony's online gaming network crashed. However, that confusion soon turned to outrage when Sony later admitted that the network was hacked and its users' personal information was stolen. Sony stated that the hackers stole information including the names, addresses, city, state, zip codes, country, email address, birth date, their PlayStation Network password and login handle and password names as well. And then in addition, they also said it's possible that profile data, including purchase history, billing address, and your credit card information might have been stolen as well.
Oops.
Yeah.
Yay, have fun.
So they didn't get to find out where I hide my +3 magic sword, did they? I mean, sure, my real-world information is important, but my avatar information, well, that is something I want to keep protected.
On a more serious note, if you do have a PlayStation Network account and you use, like, the same email address and password for everything else online, think about changing that email or the password.
Yeah,
and if you have a credit card, cancel it.
Yeah. Obviously, Sony's in real hot water for this, and this is, I think, this goes way beyond sort of the whole Apple outrage. This is actually serious problems here. They're facing lawsuits. The UK Information Commission is looking into the issue. They've received letters from the U.S. Congress, which are saying, "Okay, you've violated security and privacy related issues." They're getting sued by a class action lawsuit in California. Estimations say that Sony could end up paying out $24.5 billion in damages to its customers. This is a major breach. But I think it leads to some interesting questions here that perhaps skeptics need to take a look at.
I should say something.
Okay.
That number is total BS.
What? The 24.5
billion? That's 2.5 years worth of the total revenue the gaming industry brings in. It's not going to happen. If, like, the credit cards, like, there's a problem there. Like, there could be, like, fraudulent charges, which will rack up. And it sucks that people lost. But there's no way there's $25.4 billion of damages.
I don't think that Sony will ever be able to pay that amount of money. But, I mean, if they had to pay, say, $100 to all the people who lost their credit cards, you know, that can add up pretty quickly.
But actually, that won't happen either, because in a sort of related but not related news article from the States, I think it was last week or the week before, a Supreme Court case in the United States, and this only applies to the United States, against AT&T in California, where people had signed a contract for cell phones and they were something like overcharged $30, and they tried to do a class action lawsuit against, I think it's AT&T for this. And AT&T won its case by saying, well, in the contract that they signed, there's a provision for arbitration. And in the arbitration agreement, it says that AT&T can appoint an arbitrator to summarily decide what damages and who should get it. And obviously, if AT&T gets to decide, the arbitrator is probably going to be in their favor. I suspect if you look at the fine print of both your Apple users agreement and probably the Sony users agreement, there's probably a thing saying that if anything goes wrong ever, for whatever reason, Sony, Apple, whatever, gets to appoint an arbitrator and you can't sue us over it.
More so than that, for Sony Online, basically there's a clause in the terms that you accept in order to get on PlayStation Network, which says that they are not responsible for any loss of personal data. So basically, there is precedent, though, for courts to overturn that with egregious violations. So there probably could be a suit if there's, like, large credit card problems or identity theft.
Well, the other thing is that I was reading an article in the New York Times that a number of security experts have actually seen Sony stolen credit card information from Sony's network for sale on, like, underground forums and hacker forums and that sort of thing. So it looks like, at the very least, hackers have stolen pretty viable information and are selling it.
It seems kind of, sorry, the way you just described that, at first I kind of thought there's some master criminal or perhaps organized crime organization that hacked into Sony, got this information, took it out, and then they're going to sell it to, I don't know, North Korea or something and that. But you make it sound like, oh yeah, no, people are shoplifting every day, and you know, you'll be amazed at what people shoplift from the Sony store, and they're just selling it on Craigslist. You make it sound like there's like billions of hackers in there, and they've been hacking into it for a while now, and it's just come to light.
There's some idea that it's actually more disgruntled hackers that did this, not with any actual real intent to like steal tons of money from the customers, but Sony did a lot of things that pissed off hackers over the last few years. For instance, suing one of them and getting rid of Linux on PlayStations, which sounds like a small thing, but to many like geeks out there, this really pissed them off. And there's some idea that it was sort of lacked security and sort of amateur people just trying to piss them off that might have been this, which sounds bad, but in some cases that's almost better rather than people with like the intent to really steal money.
I don't know, actually. I almost think it's the reverse. I mean, to sit there and think that the Chinese government hacked Google, right? I'm going, well, okay, you know, Google is probably relatively secure, but nothing's 100% secure, and if an entire nation tried to hack into it, it probably can find a way in. As opposed to thinking that every 14-year-old in Canada can hack into it, suddenly gives me an entirely new level of insecurity.
I'm not exactly saying every 14-year-old. I'm saying,
like, oh, okay, 14 and 15-year-old.
Well, if we go by the evidence that we have, it does look like whoever did hack in, at least some of them had the intention of selling this personal data. And let's face it, people who sell personal data, they can make money off it. There are people out there who will take that that information. And, you know, again, it could be a bunch of, you know, pissed off geeks, but it could also be, you know, I'm sure that there are some, you know, pretty serious criminals out there who think, yeah, I can make a buck off this. So that is a possibility.
You know, and of course, that also plays into, again, I'm railing on libertarians again this week. a lot of them believe, you know, well, okay, well, see, Sony's an insecure network, so I'm just going to sell all my Sony stuff and buy the Apple. No, I can't go to Apple. I can't. And this idea of free choice. I mean, one of the reasons why I think, you know, the going to the law courts is sort of a good thing is that lots of times, you know, we think that we can trust corporations to protect our interests. And, I mean, I don't think they're evil and they're out to get us most times. But at the same time, you know, sometimes we don't have that much of a choice in what companies we get to use because there just isn't a lot of choice out there. And in that sense, these are important issues to be aware of.
To sort of half defend the libertarian point of view here.
Oh, and we're out of time for this week.
is to say that I don't think many of them have a problem with courts when there are damages to upheld. Some people might say that the terms that people sign up for are like airtight, and then can't do anything.
My argument just was is that there is really no choice to it. I mean, how many of us, when we download iTunes, read it and say, no, I'm going to go with the there is no alternative.
No alternative to iTunes? Well, there's plenty. Don't buy an iPhone.
Right. Okay, I'm going to go get the Zune. Oh, no, Zune doesn't exist anymore.
The Google Nexus S phone?
Oh, yeah, Google, which will do no evil, and they're being sued for privacy. So, but anyhow, yes, we digress. Ethan, do we have anything else about this? I mean, is it only these multimedia companies that are being hacked? I mean, I heard the other day that Epson or whatever, there's a major marketing corporation out there got hacked recently, and it in itself, just to bring our eyes up to it, I forget the exact name of the company, but it handled personal information for over 50 huge, huge corporations in the United States, 47. You know, things like Citibank and Ramada Reward Zone Points and other Reward Zone Points that I won't mention.
Like a large chunk of the big banks in the U.S.
You know, and the thing is that this one corporation had all this information, and you don't think that it's in this one corporation. What was it? The Epsilon Corporation had it. And things like TD Ameritrade, the college boards, people's SAT scores were stored there, right? And you sit there and you kind of think, oh, everyone has their own little thing. And I trust Air Miles. Air Miles is one of the ones. So they have their own servers. But no, they all offloaded onto this one company. And if so, one company gets hacked, they all kind of go down. And we don't think about how secure our information is on the virtual web, or were these people who are so paranoid about having any information on the web? And it's just, it's...
I think it leads to the question of, are we entering an era of technology where personal data is, you know, up for grabs, where we're going to have to...
No longer personal.
Well, we're just going to have to loosen our conceptions of what personal data is, because we simply cannot protect it in this era.
I don't know if it's like, I mean, there are certainly, like, it is much harder to remain anonymous, like, with personal data. Like, I mean, if you put something on Facebook, there's always a, like, potential that all this personal stuff people post is going to get disseminated, whether it be by, like, hackers or even just your friends, like, posting funny stuff. Like, if you look at, like, a website like Reddit or something, like, tons of, like, private stuff from Facebook gets posted there for all to laugh at. So, so there, we do have to sort of sit back and realize that we don't live in as private of a time. But I think there are some differences between. I think now, like before, if lots of this personal data was stored like physically in like a tiny locked like thing, some of that could get stolen. The thing is, now it can be stolen on such a large scale that it's just scarier.
Mm-hmm. But that works out good, because then you get the minnow effect. I personally have two strategies. One, when I sign up for a database, I make sure there's at least 1 to 3 billion people on it. And two, I have kept my own personal finances at such a poor state that if anyone did get my personal information, all they would get is collection agencies phoning them up saying, hey, where's our money?
Well, that was a good message to all the hackers out there, Don.
So please donate money to Don.
Yes. Let's go to a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be back with our skeptical highlights after this.
And I'm feeling good.
The 6th annual Vancouver International Burlesque Festival is coming May 5th to 7th.
Vegas.
May 5th and 6th, come down to the Rickshaw Theater for performances from Luscious Pink, Pandora and the Locksmiths, Bloody Betty and the Seven Deadly Sins, Pasties and a G-String, Sinner St. Burlesque Seattle, and Sex at the Circus. May 7th, the Vogue Theater will be on fire with performances from Burgundy Bricks, Roxy Delight, Judith Stein, April Opeel, Cheesecake Burlesque, Kitty Knights, Starlet Harlots, and many, many more.
For tickets, a complete festival schedule, and as much titillating information as you can handle, go online to vanburlesquefest.com. Butterflies all having fun, you know what I mean.
My name's Chris Horrific.
You always wanted his character to be bigger than life.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is, without question, the greatest sports and entertainment event of all time. Be a part of it, Monday.
From 1 to 3 p.m.
The Parts Unknown Show on 101.9 CITR. Sometimes cosmoses collide.
Fingers. We're back on Radio Free Thinker. So we should wrap up today's episode, I think. It's been a good one. Let's go into our skeptical highlights. Tomorrow is Skeptics in the Pub in Kitsilano, May 4th, 7:30 at the Billy Bishop Legion. It's always a fun time, so come on out. And of course, later on, we have the Imagine No Religion Conference, Saturday, May 7th in Kamloops, with an impressive lineup of speakers and events.
Yes, and tonight, if you already have tickets or you want to wait in line and hope there are tickets, Craig Venter is giving a talk at The Vogue. It starts at 7:30. The tickets will be released at 7:15, so line up if you want to try and get in. Afterwards, the UBC Freethinkers are probably going to head out to a nearby pub if there's interest, so join us there if you come to the talk.
Excellent. And I'm either going to have a good one or I'm going to be so off base I'll be embarrassed for months, maybe even hours. Coming up, I believe, is Mother's Day. I believe next Sunday is Mother's Day, if I'm remembering correctly.
You are very correct.
And May 8th. That being said, first of all, thank you, Mom, for everything you've done. It's been wonderful. I love you very much. I'm sure that's reflected by our other host.
Yeah, your mom's great.
Thank you, She's Mom. Awesome. Yeah.
And so just as a note for Skeptic Highlights, we should all go out and get Mom something special. They're very important people in our life. And as I mentioned before, I'm poor, so this is what you get, Mom. Enjoy it.
All right, then. Well, this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian.
Oh,
saying
one more thing.
Never interrupt my farewell speech.
Sorry, but Jacob insisted I say something.
What?
That's it. Okay.
What the hell?
This is what I deal with, folks, on a weekly basis. This is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
This is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
And this is Daniel. I have nothing to say anymore.
So long, folks.